Antisthenes 2. In his writings, Grandfather argues that he was better for it, better than those who were called the perfects in those old days, whom we now call genomes. For they would have us believe we are all perfects. They tell us to dignify us. And so we are, in fact, except that most of us are called out to be images, to serve those who will be perfected. Genomes are valued above all because perfectly replicating the most desirable genes, they are essentially identical. That is why your mother and I look alike. Though evidently I had an error and was therefore called and given to my parents to raise as an image. Of course, you cannot tell an image from a genome as a practical matter. You cannot tell the image from the genome to look at them side by side, and yet there is a certain attitude, almost an inexplicable presence, like an interior light that shows. Or rather, that the genome displays, which distinguishes them, and in a crowded car or at an education, you can always tell which is which. It is in their manner, really. Confidence, self-shining self-knowledge. Except that it was strangely wrong in my case. I had that same shining, that confidence. In that way, I always resembled the genome myself. It was not intentional or willful on my part. I do not know why I possessed that semblance, though I was an image. But only your mother ever knew, and then only because I told her, because I wanted her to truly love me. I can see that same shining in you. You have it too. They would all think you are genome too, though you are a bastard. Of course, you look nothing like everyone else. That is the problem. That is why you cannot come with me. You must not follow me. Stay with your mother. Grandfather held that perfect shall be imperfect in any case, because they are not natural. It is a difficult argument to grasp, I know, but you must try to understand him. What is perfect, he said, shall fail, must fail, because the natural is imperfect, and therefore only the natural shall survive. He held this belief in what is called in our education survivalism, which I was taught was an error. It is a strange idea to the perfect, because they think it is bitter and cowardly. They think it will permit what will, arguing that what survives must be good. And thus it opposes the liberty of man, because of the will of man. By his liberty he may change. So I was taught. But Grandfather held fast to his error, to his belief in nature, as it was called. He refused to accept that only the perfect shall be saved. For his denials, he was often brought to educations, but these did not succeed in his case. He adamantly resisted, or cleverly deceived his educators. And in those days, they did not so effectively repair errors as they do today. The Velitas appliances are effective today. All tracks of experience are scoured by the new appliance. They become painful by the Velitas, which repairs them. You see? So the repaired is not only renewed, what is previous is horrid and repulsive. The repairs today are so effective, the repaired will not remember being repaired. But Grandfather did remember. Grandfather remembered, and he wrote what he remembered. Read for yourself. I brought him the drink. He drank it and died. He afterwards despised me for this, I understand, but it was what he wanted. He knew that I would do what he asked. That is why he asked it of me. Strange that the educators had left, but perhaps they were ashamed after all, and he felt pity for them. They were such cowards, hypocrites. And this shall make me angry for a long time. For they therefore showed that they knew they were wrong, but they would do what was wrong. I was angry for a long time. I could not understand a cowardice like this. I was very arrogant. I never went home again. I could not speak to my wife or any of those whom I had grown up with whom now I had nothing in common, and who seemed to me so out of touch with what was real. Their denial made them all foolish. My convictions, on the other hand, frightened them. They believed I was insane. And I suppose that is how I seemed. I lived with the others in the streets. I did not become quite antic like so many others became, dumpster divers, pranksters, litter in the wind. There was nothing to rebel against anyway. Who cares? I did not have appetite for life after he died. I did not want to eat. The educators persecute those who speak back to them, but I have nothing to say to them. I hold them in contempt, but quietly. I should not speak to slugs or bugs. Why to them? I keep myself clean. I seem respectable. I am careful to keep respectable appearance, for I see what they do with the others. One day, madcap and unclean, the next day in a jumpsuit, empty eye holes. Sent to proselytize the frightened in the streets. A hole where a mouth ought to be. Recorded messages sounding expressionless from the speaker. They know who I am, but they presume I am repaired. I idle in the courts. I watch the trials. I study the prosecutor who had won the capital case against him and the others. I studied his rhetorical style. How should such arguments persuade men? They were not an appeal to facts. Or rather, they were an appeal to facts contrived to persuade. I saw that what passes for truth is what affirms that which is believed to be true. Truth is not sought. Truth is wrought. An educator struck me today when I laughed at something the prosecutor said, which was not supposed to be funny. A mistake. I thanked him for the pain he gave me. When the educators, thinking to belittle him, then slandered his parents for not being perfects, while in fact they were, Grandfather said, "Well, they weren't dogs either, but still, I am a dog." They laughed. I laughed. We all laughed together, and they let me go, even though I just pissed on their leg. There are pages and pages like this. Most of what was written when he was cyberpunked. Parts taken out of the texting he made during the trashing when he and others who believed as he did could still gather at the public libraries and work their computers until they were closed to them. Eventually, of course, all the libraries were closed, when the only ones who were finally allowed to use them were those who never wanted to use them anyway. So they were closed for good. His writings are all a jumble, like so much trash in several trash bags that he had carried around with him as he moved about the streets where he lived. Pages and pages of the stuff, loose, mixed, Sometimes scraps of paper he used, hot dog wrappers with mustard stains, snotty napkins, flaps of cardboard. Things he'd text on when something occurred to him, and he did not have a computer. Like this one. I'd rather be crazy on the streets than live sane in society. I'd rather all the pain of this than any of the pleasure of that. Or this one. It's a compliment to be ridiculed for doing the right thing. Someone, my mother, I suppose, had put them together, copying them, put them into several string-tied, dirty bundles. For example, there were the stories, which included The Short of It, in which he wrote about how it all began, and later, The Survivalist Papers. The texting he did from the days in the street and at the computers in the public library. And then she had this mishmash of dissociated aphorisms. I myself later tried to collate and catalog these bits and pieces, but I have long since just given up and taken them as she passed them along to me. The original papers and printouts are lost anyway. What I like, I like. The stories, mostly. His ideas seem to me mostly self-evidently true, but I love his stories. You can find more truth in a story than you can ever find in philosophy because of what is not said. He had a dog. My mother told me this story. I don't know where it's written, so this must be the first time here. He called the dog Death. It went with him everywhere. He talked to it all the time. He held fierce debates with it. The dog always got the better of him, and it infuriated him. He would leave in a heat to sulk and bitch, but always return to apologize. He said the dog was never smug or condescending, though he was always right. He got so impressed with his intelligence that he decided he ought to be elected director. People mocked him for saying it, but he was insistent. He went into the streets with petitions he got printed. He put his name on the shareholders' ballot and stood at the transit gate with a handmade placard with the dog's picture on it, a slogan crayoned above his sappy face promoting his election, "You can trust a dog." In an alley in the city where he lived, sleeping in a hovel of broken-down crates with others who also lived there, like himself, quote, "free from social chains," unquote, so he said. He was pestered by a young admirer whose father was a corporate executive, whose mother was a high official in the education department. He was followed by him day and night, in and out of the alley. Had food and words taken out of his mouth, and for everything snatched, the young thief professed that he would soon repay it, that he would soon be getting a large amount of money. A whole boatload, he said. Grandfather got rid of him when taking him to a posh restaurant, and after feeding themselves sumptuously on its most expensive fare, he excused himself from the table to use the restroom, but left the restaurant, commenting to the cashier as he departed to give the bill to the young man whom he said sails fantastically on a sea of money. When he thought someone stole his knapsack from the library, where he had set it down while he had gone off into the stacks, many of those pages and pages, scraps and waste paper, bits of thought were lost and gone. But then he said, "It just proves that anything you can lose is not so important after all. It is just so much trash." After that, he took to keeping all his writings in trash bags. He texts this about that. "The only possession worth having is the only one that won't get wet in a shipwreck." think about it. If you figure it out, then you will have everything you'll ever need. But let me start at the starting point. Grandfather was a perfect, born to perfects. He grew up a perfect. He married a perfect and had perfect children. One of them is your ancestor, of course, my mother's great-grandmother, I think. Funny how it is that the women in the family kept the memory alive. If it was not for these women preserving what was written, we would have nothing about him, except, of course, what they tell us in the network. I am actually surprised I found anything in the network, since mostly they want to ignore what they do not want us to know, thinking that if we do not know about it, it cannot affect us. Of course, what made Grandfather what he is, that is also what made me. Or perhaps not. Perhaps my mother's intervention saved me from myself. But the networks only tell you that Grandfather, whom they identified by the sobriquet Antisthenes, because it was the lead to his texting on computers, was one of the survivalists, so called by the philosophy of their renowned and martyred mentor, but moreover caricatured by their habit of living on the streets by their wits, eating wild things, even before the village. They were nihilists, according to the vids of the network celebrities who mock them, and who tell ludicrous stories of outrageous things which survivalists allegedly did. Some of the stories are true, of course. The trashing began after the trials. Grandfather was influenced by his witness of the trials. He had been a network programmer when the trials began. A certain distinguished and honored celebrity was arrested for unauthorized commentary, for allegedly survivalist opinions. I cannot tell you clearly what these opinions were. I suppose they were criticisms of perfection. The corporations believed the opinions subversive. But this charismatic fellow had obtained among his habitual viewers such a popular following that he was permitted to be a part of the network for much longer than they should have permitted him to be. So the reaction on his arrest disturbed everyone. Remember, this was before perfection had been perfected, in the early days of the city-states, and the systems were still under development. There was still some sympathy for the ordinary, some outrage for their mistreatment, some debate about the right of perfection. Many young people especially took to protesting his arrest, but also Grandfather, because he knew him from the network, had worked with him, and had admired him. He was deeply influenced by him. He attended the trial. He visited him where he was incarcerated. He was permitted because they had hoped he would persuade the man to change his opinions. Grandfather was duplicitous in this way. He acted the part of a double agent deftly. The corporations wanted the celebrity's public statement of regret and remorse and a recommitment to perfection. They hoped Grandfather could persuade him. They did not want his martyrdom, but he took his own life rather than recant. Grandfather says he aided his death. The networks tell none of this. In the network, we are told that the seditious celebrity took his own life because of his disgrace. But in the aftermath, the young survivalists began to trash the network. Grandfather was among them, but does not write much about the trashing. Generally, the survivalists mistrusted him. Some suspected he had poisoned the celebrity against his will. Then, when many more were arrested and the libraries were closed, Grandfather was alienated from both the educators and the deviants. But neither knew quite what to make of him, since both distrusted him. The practice of repair, the network explains, began at that time, practiced for the first time upon these deviants. A reference to Grandfather's dog, Death, is also included in this video litany, but it is made a matter of ridicule. It is implied that Grandfather was simple-minded. Maybe Grandfather wanted them to think that. At any rate, he himself was never repaired. In The Short of It, Grandfather tells where he comes from. His father was a private physician to executives of the corporations, practicing at their exclusive hospital, located in the Alps, as it still is. Switzerland, losing its glaciers and now in many places desolate and arid, no longer the cut jewel of old Europe, though still the bank of bankers, is barren and salt-rimmed, like the bare bleached spine of the Italian peninsula where every coastal place was flooded, fabled to memory and uninhabited now. He was raised in those Alps, while a few meager melting glaciers still clung and watered a few small sacred emerald vales with lakes like salty teardrops. After the deluge and the creation of the new city-states, when he was barely 6 years old, his family was relocated to New Chicago, near the old Continental River, aggregating all cities of the peninsula in the Great Lake. This is also where I came from. Grandfather learned to read and write, as it was still taught in the ancient way in those days, much as you have been taught. The neural and genetic technologies of the perfect society soon revolutionized education, but when he was a young man, there were classical institutions of education. They no longer exist now, gone with the deluge and perfection. Imagine them, whole villages devoted to learning, whole buildings full of books. If you had been born in the perfect society, you would not have learned to read and write, like Grandfather. You would have been culled, and your education would have been managed according to your profile. Now the genome is educated exclusively by nurturing. Interneural capillaries are insinuated when the genomic resample is culled and isolated from those who shall become images, such as I. Images, the imperfect, like me, like you, are educated more or less in the normal way by rote memory, by repetitive lessons, entirely of vids, of course, forcibly, methodically, repetitively layered upon the embryonic eyelids, the object of which is to provide me a purpose. I am programmed to the purpose. What I feel or see, I am programmed to feel and see. I want to do only what I am programmed to do. Not to do what I am programmed causes me suicidal despair. The image is segmented into portions of human potential, whereas the genome is unlimited. The genome is imbued with every potential. The select one is enveloped in comfortable tissue, and while in a state of hypnotic, fixed, solipsistic awareness, is flooded with the Solaris Nutrium Mysterium, a rich complex of neurooperant biofluids in which he or she is swiftly perfected in the same way you incubate tadpoles in a jar of cloudy pond water. The maturation of his being and his brain is twice that of the ordinary. It has been technologically so improved that he or she has genius intelligence before 8 years and is pre-gifted with saturates of knowledge and skills so that these might seem to be innate, although in fact they are induced or implanted. Redundantly multiplied neurons layered like silica sediment, reduplicative because most shall break. This stimulated maturation profoundly affects the body, physically developing at accelerated scales. They are sexually mature at age 8 because of special diets and medicines. In the case of genomic females, they are fully fit to harvest at age 10 for the treasured ovum, which are taken, surgically removed, before they are really born. And when born, though barely 12 years in age, they resemble fully grown adult, though yet children in their experience. They shall be called children. By law, they are children, until they are admitted to a place in society after their social awakening is processed. The development of their minds, I do admit, is the most amazing science. The physical development may be understood even as our modest experiments with manure and pollination here in the village, but how the minds of these virtually identical minds are also matured in the incubus, I do not know. But I suppose it must be the same or similar technology that they have developed to repair those whose minds are not fit for society, because some errors do occur. A statistical variance, they calculate. Even those perfects, culled, are not entirely without error, and the error will out. Noticed usually by some faithless sarcasm in attitude, impolitic remarks to educators or parents or colleagues who might report them. I have seen it. One day, a true individual, nasty-minded as grandfather might be, starting to act out, and then overnight, taken away, they come back the next day a perfect image. Re-imaged, some call it, rather than repaired. It's like they have hosed out their skulls, blasted out every bit of their brains and being, and what was once inside there, which made their smiles and their eyes peculiarly their own, is just clean gone. But in those days, before education as we know it, as I was telling you, grandfather was given the writing to read. He was free to read as he pleased, and given limitless opportunity to read all and anything he wished. Nothing was prescribed. He was nonetheless a faithful perfect. Why not? Everything had been arranged, everything given to him, every opportunity, every pleasure. It is natural to prefer what is pleasingly given for good. In the days before the deluge, the singular fortune of perfects was to own and to rule, not unlike today, except that now the privileges of genomes are disguised. After the deluge, during the People's Wars, ordinary people attacked the perfect and murdered them for the advantages they had, and just to take from them their possessions, or from outrage, for the injustice of their pleasure their survival at the expense of the ordinary. The superiority of the genomes, if not naturally, then militarily, made the war one-sided. The ordinary were annihilated. A few may have escaped to the map, but masses were drowned, starved, destroyed by nucleonic weapons. The city-states once alone were safe from the effects of these disasters, isolated in their impenetrable involutions and the web of interstitial transits, deeply and safely submerged. The ordinary who remained in the city-states were sterilized, if not assassinated. Genomic perfection was strictly enforced. Society divided between the perfect and the imperfect, but all of us are of one and only one kind. Today, the genome is disguised in likeness from the imperfect image. All of us look alike. All of us essentially are treated alike, or so we suppose. The difference is invisible and unacknowledged. The difference is behind doors. Those on the other side know the difference. Those of us outside never will know how much difference there is. We are told we're treated the same. Except that your mother told me. I should not have known. You should ask her to tell you while you can, when I'm gone. By the time Grandfather had escaped, he had not seen all that was to come. By the time I was a young man, a century and more later, I would escape worse than he ever knew. This is the story of how I escaped. I know you know some of it, but I never told you why. This is why.